You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, March 24th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, an interview I did last week with Barrett Brown from federal prison. He was sentenced in January to 63 months, having had served about 2.5 years of that. Well, I guess at this point, 2.5 years. Also on the program today, Israel spies on the U.S. Surprise, surprise. We probably spy on them. But what I don't think that we do is give away that information to undermine the Israeli government. In fact, I think if we did that, that would probably be against our law.
Major scandal.
Also on the program today, more reactions from the first one in the clown car. You got to get in early because that's when you get to stretch out. Turn the radio station to your favorite tunes. Also on the program today, Supreme Court refuses to hear Wisconsin's voter ID law. Mickey D's spent the weekend spreading joy. Except, of course, to their workers. And an upstate New York school does the stupidest, most ignorant thing. Or let me say this. They may have responded in the only way they could. But the people who complained about that school did so in the most stupidest and ignorant way possible. Climate change, apparently, is still a problem in this country and in China. And a federal judge on Friday ordered that those 2,000 photos the government has been attempting to keep from releasing, or I guess prevent their release of the torture our government performed, or I guess those rogue people who tortured, despite the fact that they were also sort of encouraged to do so. Those photos, unless there is further legal action, I think are going to be released soon. And the World Health Organization says that it's Monsanto's Roundup Ready probably causes cancer. That and more on today's program. So before we get into the Barrett Brown interview, today is the last day, ladies and gentlemen, that you can vote on the podcast awards for us. So please, one last chance, one last lick at the ice cream cone. Podcastawards.com. Vote for us for best news in politics. Also, our Indiegogo campaign is going great. If you haven't checked it out, just go to themajorityreport.com. We're at over 50%. And we added more of those DVD collections, the full Cedar Works. Plus, and the added bonus, which nobody has ever seen, is the first version of Beat Cops with John Benjamin and I. And I had Asif Manvi's in that, Judy Gold, Nick DiPaolo, if you can believe it. This was a show that I did, 15, 16 years ago now for Studios USA. It was an independent, they gave us a low budget, and I was at that time making a lot of money just in a holding deal to be an actor. And I basically went to, if you can believe it, Henry Kissinger's son at the time, who was head of Studios USA, and said, for a fraction of what I'm being held for in a for a sitcom for NBC, I will actually deliver you a show. And so he was able to sell that to Barry Diller. I think we met with Barry Diller at the time. Went in, pitched it to him, and we did the show, and it ultimately ended up being redone with Benjamin and I for Conoco and Fox, but this is the original one. So few people have seen that. And so we sold out of those. So we basically did another, put up another 65 that are available. It's going like hotcakes already. I think we've already gotten five. We've gotten, you know, we've already been taken up. So check it out, themajoritireport.com. We've talked about Barrett Brown on this program in the past, and I guess it was now year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I emceed a fundraiser for Barrett Brown and Jeremy Hammond. Jeremy Hammond basically hacked into Stratfor, which is a security intelligence firm, and I believe, I'm not sure, HB Gary Federal. Nevertheless, emails involving both those organizations were released online, and it outlined, at the very least, what was a pitch to the U.S. government. It's unclear how far this went, but these are companies that do industrial spying and some spying for the federal government. And it outlined a plan to essentially discredit and attack people like Glenn Greenwald. I think Glenn Greenwald was actually named. Supporters of WikiLeaks, essentially. Or anybody they perceive to be supportive of WikiLeaks. And Barrett Brown was ultimately sent to prison. There was a plea deal. Initially, he was being charged by the federal government for linking, for basically seeding a link, putting a link in a chat forum to that material, which also, I don't think he was, and he was unaware of at the time, included credit card information of some of those companies' clients. There was such pushback because, I mean, contemplate the notion of this. You link every day. Every day in your Twitter feed, you're getting a link to stuff. You have to be responsible for everything in that link if it's already been made public. It's just absurd. No journalist could do their job. And Barrett Brown, make no mistake about it. I mean, I don't know how we define journalists in this country, but he wrote for many major publications, ones that you read every day, ones that I read stories from every day. So the government ultimately dropped those charges because I think they were untenable. And ultimately, Barrett Brown signed a plea deal, pleading guilty to charges related to, one, a YouTube video he made against a specific FBI agent who had apparently threatened his mom with going to jail as a way of getting her to talk. Now, his YouTube video was not explicitly calling for violence, more sort of implying he's going to look into his family. And he, I think, concedes that was a big mistake. That was actually not even close in his plea agreement to what accounted for the vast majority of his time that he received. He was also pled guilty to a misdemeanor obstruction charge for attempting to hide two laptops when FBI agents arrived at his mother's home to execute a search warrant. Again, that also did not constitute the bulk of his sentence. The third charge was an accessory after the fact, which came from essentially Brown's willingness and making it clear to Hammond, I believe, and Anonymous that he would act as an intermediary with Stratfor, because Anonymous had these emails and they were concerned that they were going to endanger the lives of potential sources of information in foreign countries. I believe one of them was Bahrain. Pro-democracy activists and the like. Hammond made an offer to Stratfor to be the intermediary in terms of what redactions should take place. Now, we see this all the time, right? Journalists do this all the time. They get information, they approach the State Department. I've received a document dump. We're going to publish it, but we want to give you the opportunity to tell us what might be too sensitive so that we don't do any damage to sort of innocent third parties here. For that, he was charged with being an accessory after the fact. And I don't know. It seems to me a very strange way of reading that of the law there, because it doesn't seem like he was seeking to profit in any way or actually aiding and abetting those hackers in any way. He seems to me he was aiding and abetting those people mentioned in the hack. But I don't know. So here is the interview with Barrett Brown. Apparently there's a lot of this stuff has been under seal. Some of it less so now, but even less in the years coming. But here is Barrett Brown. The interview that we got was starting from the moment he had to call us. He's calling from prison. It ends a little bit abruptly, as you will note. And all right, here it is. Go right into it.
You have a prepaid call. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from
Barrett Brown,
an inmate at a federal prison. Hang up to decline the call or to accept. Dial 5 now. If you wish to block any future calls of this nature.
Hello.
Barrett.
How you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for doing this.
Happy to do so.
How much time do you have?
15 minutes.
Okay. All right, well, then we'll go right into it. Barrett, let's for people who aren't aware of your case, I think most of our audience has some broad awareness. You, in I guess it was January of this year, were sentenced to 5 years and 3 months. You have served at this point 2.5 years of those 5 years, 3 months. You struck a plea deal and pled guilty on three charges. Tell us what those three charges are.
The original charge that underlies the investigation justifies the several years of search warrants and harassment and all that that they managed to stick was the accessory after the fact. That was sort of a consolation prize to them after they originally charged me with a number of fraud charges that didn't make a great deal of sense, and which, when they made those public a couple years ago, caused sort of a firestorm of controversy and resulted in the U.S. Losing a number of places on the Reporters Without Borders press rankings. And the charge that I eventually pled to, this history after the fact charge, is for after a hack occurred on a company called Strapper, which does sort of black ops, provides black ops services to other companies, I, on behalf of the hackers, contacted the company and said, you know, if there's anything in these emails they've just stolen from you that they're about to put out that could get somebody hurt in a foreign country, and if you have any contacts under a dictatorship or that sort of thing, let me know and I'll have them redact them. And that was the, that's the conduct that, that I pled to, and which is apparently a crime. It allegedly I helped the hackers escape, which doesn't make a great deal of sense. But and then there was also another charge, which eventually pled to, was interference with a search warrant, originally obstruction of justice. That was for hiding laptops from the FBI when I knew they were coming to raid me. I didn't want the FBI to have those laptops for a number of reasons. As I noted in the Daily Beast article I wrote about a month ago, among other things, those laptops contain information about my contacts in Bahrain and other dictatorships where the U.S. has bases and with which the U.S. government cooperates. And obviously, to put that information in the hands of the federal government would have been irresponsible. The final charge, internet threats, that was for videos I made when I was self-detoxing off opiates at the time. I had been raided 6 months prior, and my mom was being threatened with an indictment by the FBI. I said in these videos that I made at the time, I was sort of in a manic state, that if they're going to investigate me, I was going to investigate them, and I was going to do it the same way that a certain CEO named Aaron Barr had done. Aaron Barr was the head of a company called H.P. Gary that we had investigated previous, which really started this whole thing off. Our investigation of that revealed that he was going to do some sort of nasty, again, black ops propaganda work on behalf of companies in a conspiracy that was set in motion by the DOJ. Anyway, so that was a sort of ill-conceived, kind of manic attempt on my part to bring attention to what was happening to me at that point, this investigation, these threats against my family by the FBI, and to also make a point about what the allies of the FBI, like Aaron Barr, got away with. So those are the charges that I eventually pled to. I was facing a number of others, and altogether, as you may probably be aware, in fact, I believe you actually emceed my a fundraiser for Jerry Hammond and myself. So you know this. I was facing about 105 years altogether at one point.
And ultimately, I think, you know, the attention surrounding the first set of charges of you simply linking or seeding a link to these materials, I think, frankly, there was just far too much pushback. But so let me ask you this. You're also responsible for almost $900,000 in restitution. What is that supposedly based upon?
The majority of that is about, I think it's $870,000 that I owe just to Stratfor, the company that Jeremy Hammond hacked at the end of 2011. The Strapper, like I said, is a company that employs former State Department officials and provides clandestine and really quasi-illegal services to companies like Dow Chemical, for instance. They spy on activists on their behalf. The grievous thing that was uncovered in that...
This call is from a federal prison.
Yes, that's very charming. They spied on Bhopal activists on behalf of Union Carbide and Dow Chemical. You know, the Yes Men, the group that's trying to get for reparations for those who were killed or wounded in the Union Carbide explosion in the 80s. They do things of that nature. And after the hack was done, as I always do, and as the FBI knows perfectly well that I do, I was investigating the emails that were taken in that hack. And in doing so, I copied and pasted a link from one chat room to another, to the one that run by my group, Project PM. And the link led to, in this case, a file that, among other things, contained customer information for Strapper, for the newsletter they put out, which is a small part of what they do, which included credit card numbers. Now, I never knew those numbers were in there. It's very clear from the transcript of the IRC chat that I didn't know they were in there. I never used them. They were already being used days before by the actual hackers. And there's nothing linking me to any of those charges that were made even after I pasted the link. And the link was already public, was linked to by other people. I never opened the file, et cetera, et cetera. So it was obviously an extraordinarily absurd thing to charge me with. And this conduct led to 11 counts of aggravated identity theft, carrying a mandatory minimum of 22 years in prison. So that was obviously a red flag to a lot of people who I think otherwise might not have followed this case, that showed that, hey, they're retaliating against this guy for something. They're obviously looking for something to hit him with. So what did he really do? And the answer, of course, was that I had been active in investigating and bringing attention to conduct by companies linked to the DOJ and linked to the FBI, which had been carrying out crimes on behalf of the government, on behalf of certain corporations. And all that information, we kept at echelon2.org, a website we created for the purpose, and which actually is mentioned in the original search warrants. So it was really a debacle for them, and those charges, I think, was obviously a major tactical error on their behalf that really, I think, just single-handedly show what's really going on here.
And so let me get your sense of and expand on that last. Well, before we do that, much of your the proceedings have been under seal, and my understanding is that over the next 6 months to a year, a lot more of that information is going to come to light. Can you give us a sense of what's going to come to light, and how is that going to sort of further undercut the reasons why the government went after you?
Well, it's going to be, I think it's going to be really just the frosting on the cake.
This call is from a federal prison.
Based on what I've seen in the media coverage, I don't think anyone at all at this point is believes their story at all. But it will help to confirm what we've been saying, which is that this was a situation in which there was not an underlying crime. This was a situation in which, on behalf of several companies that work with the DOJ, I was prosecuted. I was investigated for a long time in ways that are very unconventional, to say the least, or at least I would hope are unconventional, in which they violated the law, in which people associated with the FBI and these companies violated the law. Even before a lot of this information comes out, which will be in the next few months, there will be an article by Douglas Lucas coming out, I think probably the next week or so, that goes into a lot of those details. On the conduct on behalf of certain companies, particularly H.B. Gary Federal, which I'm sure we'll get into in a moment. There's a great deal that's still sealed. I don't know the exact specifics of what the status is, what's going to take for us to get it in the public eye, but I'm going to eventually myself be writing about this. I don't know which venue yet, quite a bit, frankly, for years and years, because there's so much material here. There are transcripts of hearings that are still sealed in which, for instance, they point out I'm an anarchist and use that as an argument that I should do more prison time because I have unconventional political views. There's further instances of perjury that I referenced briefly in my allocution, which is public, and also in the Daily Beast article. There's just a great deal of perjury, unambiguous perjury, that I think when people don't get a chance to see federal cases and how this works very often. My case is an extreme example. It's one in which they really wanted to get me. But it's emblematic of how this process works. And unfortunately, perjury is not punished. And when it's not punished and it helps get convictions, well, you get plenty of it. There's a great problem in this country that goes beyond these narrow issues I was involved in investigating. It goes beyond the intelligence contracting and cyber industrial complex. It really speaks to the absence of the rule of law, which I think as a culture, as a republic, we need to sit down and address these in a serious manner at some point soon. Because if we don't, the alternative is going to be more groups on my end of things. And it's going to be a situation in which you have just increased conflicts that may not resolve in the way that we really want it to. So I hope this case presents an opportunity. I hope the information that's going to come out in the next few months is taken advantage of by everyone involved, everyone concerned, and used to sort of bring home to more of the press that there is a serious problem here that affects them. That needs to be addressed.
When I've looked over the things that you pled to, it was 18 U.S. 3, I think, in the accessory after the fact, which is when you're supposedly comforting or assisting the offender in order to prevent his or her apprehension or trial or punishment. And, of course, you were approaching Stratfor in terms of giving them the opportunity to do redactions, like you say. Let me ask you two questions. One, do you see this in the context of the other prosecutions we have seen, particularly around, you know, obviously Aaron Swartz was involved in something that was very different from what you were doing, but there seems to have been and probably continues to be at the DOJ a strong overreaction to the idea of hackers, of Anonymous, of WikiLeaks, all of whom you have some association in, to some degree or another. I mean, do you see it as part and parcel of that, or do you see it as part and parcel, frankly, of sort of the war on journalism that this administration has been up to?
I mean, there's several overlapping frameworks you can look at this in pretty accurately. I think that both of those things are accurate. The information freedom movement, as you might as well call it, that encompasses all these groups, WikiLeaks and what Aaron Swartz was doing and what we were doing, is a considerable threat to the nation state. That's just a fact. The unfortunate fact of modern life and political life in general throughout history is that states do terrible things. They do them, or elements within states do them, and then they have to keep them covered up. And then, of course, when a process comes about where it becomes very easy for that information to get out and be distributed, then the state has to react, just like a wounded animal. What you're seeing is that reaction. It's a lashing out that's not very well directed, oftentimes sort of really incompetent in some cases, but very energetic. And that's what you've been seeing the past 5 or 6 years. It was what I was looking at a couple of years ago when WikiLeaks was first getting prosecuted, or I should say persecuted, because there was no formal prosecution, which really drove me to start acting and to get involved with Anonymous and that sort of thing. Just a lawlessness on the part of the state that justifies its existence via law. It's a nasty thing to see up close. So yes, it can be viewed in any number of those contexts. And obviously, the people involved with Aaron Swartz, people involved with WikiLeaks, they all see it as part of the same thing.
Well, we have just about a minute and a half left by my calculation. I mean, give me your sense of how has the establishment media, the mainstream press, I mean, do you feel that there has been enough attention to your case?
I'm happy with the quality of the attention for the most part that's come from some of these outlets in the last couple of years. Obviously, it would, in a more perfect world, some of the aspects of this case, in particular them seizing the Declaration of Independence from my house as evidence of a crime, would have gotten national attention. That's just something that needs to be examined, that someone needs to answer for. There's a number of things like that I think should have gotten more attention. Unfortunately, and I've worked in the media for a long time in different areas, it's a very haphazard process, what
right.
it follows and what it doesn't. It's just we didn't quite manage to get the coverage that we probably should have, and that's just the name of that's just how things are, unfortunately.
With the remaining time that we have left, is there anything else that you wanted to say to folks?
Yeah, the information at echelon2.org, a lot of people have gone to prison for. So please make use of it. If you're an activist, if you're interested in information, please do what you can to make sure that information gets.
All right. Well, I mean, I guess we can. I'm not sure how much longer we have left, but we will certainly link to that, of course, at majority.fm. And Barrett, just in general, I mean, how are your spirits?
I'm fine. I enjoy being incarcerated. It's very relaxing.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, then I guess, wow. There it is, folks. He left me speechless at the end there. I really don't know. I mean, I don't know Barrett Brown personally. I know that he's got a bit of a sense of humor, but I don't know if he was joking about that or not, frankly. So this story here, I'm going to try and do this. Israel spied on the Iran-U.S. talks. Apparently, they obtained sensitive information about the nuclear talks between Iran and the U.S., which, not terribly surprising as far as these things go. We obviously spy on
our allies. That's been quite clear from the Snowden materials. Should be no surprise that Israel is spying on us. The part that's really astonishing in this report, as far as I'm concerned, is that they gave the information to members of Congress, presumably those who are looking to scuttle the Iran deal, and I guess U.S. legislatures use this information in an attempt to undermine U.S. diplomacy. As one senior U.S. official briefed on the matter said, it's one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It's another for Israel to steal U.S. secrets, play them back to U.S. legislatures, and undermine U.S. diplomacy. I wonder what you'll recall that there was time where the Department of Justice was talking about prosecuting journalists for receiving stolen information. I mean, one has to wonder, I mean, presumably these lawmakers knew where this information was coming from. One has to wonder what the culpability is there. Seen no reports on that, but this is, obviously this stuff doesn't get out there. These stories don't get out there unless the administration is trying to make a case as to why U.S. policy is going to shift in regards to Israel. Simultaneously, yesterday, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough was speaking to the J Street Conference in Washington, arguing that we cannot simply pretend these comments were never made, speaking about Netanyahu's announcing that he would never except a Palestinian state, essentially saying the past 20 years of U.S. negotiations and my pretense over the past 5 or 6 years has been a lie. Now, he's tried to back off this stuff, but, the cat's out of the bag. It's not like I think people who are experts in these fields weren't aware of the fact that Netanyahu was playing a game, but now it's out in the open. That's the way that international diplomacy happens. McDonough then went on to say, Israel cannot maintain military control of another people indefinitely. An occupation that has lasted for almost 50 years must end. This is pretty serious stuff coming from the administration, and it'll be interesting to see how this goes into effect. I have to admit that I could not help myself and emailed the Wall Street Journal story to Indy Mike to see how he would want a strong leader to respond to something like this. So, it'll be interesting to see where we go from there. All right, we're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program, wherein we will hear the latest from, Peter King, Congressman Peter King, is trying to differentiate himself from the Ted Cruz's in the world, and it's basically ethnicity for these guys. I don't know. It's unclear. Donald Trump, at least he's consistent. Also, we talk about this school in upstate New York, and it's just rather depressing on how ignorant Americans can be sometimes. I mean, just full-on ignorance. Also, we'll talk about Mickey D's spreading the joy everywhere around the globe yesterday. except for to their workers. And all that and more. Folks, apparently the podcast awards have shut down now. We were under the impression that they were going to midnight tonight on the 24th. They were open this morning.
Yeah, and it even said on the site, March 24th.
At 2100. 2100 Pacific time, I think it was.
I think it was Eastern, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, 2100 is...
It's like 9 o'clock, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But they apparently shut it down at 1200. That would be 12 noon. Because I voted this morning. So it is what it is. Voting is shut down. Well, I guess we'll find out later. But, of course, we still have our Indiegogo campaign. We are at 60% now after 8 days. I guess we got like 40 days to do this. So very much appreciated. We have a couple other perks that we're going to put in there that are going to be at price points higher than the ones in there. We got a great offer from the graphic illustrator, Don Quixote. I'm sure you've seen his work around on the interwebs. Also, a couple other things we're working on. We're going to put those up soon. For longtime fans of the program, we're actually having to edit this stuff together a little bit because it was always a little bit hinky. But those original Marin v. Cedar episodes that we did before Break Room Live, we've got. And we'll be putting those up shortly as well. And, of course, you can show your support for the program by becoming a member at majority.fm, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority FM blend. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Costs you nothing. You'll notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Just go there, majorityreportkickback.com, click on the link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon stuff through there, and we get a kickback. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll take your IMs. We'll be right back after this.
Before we go, they it seems like they might have pushed out the new page on Podcast Awards early because now it shows back up that voting is still open.
Voting is still open on Podcast Awards.
They don't know what they're doing, but voting is open.
Voting
is
still
today,
open.
Now.
They obviously set it for the wrong time. All right, we'll be right back.